If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition Smart Bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hi, this is Billie Jean King.
This is Marion Bartoli.
I'm Mats Wilander.
This is Mary Carillo.
This is Pam Shriver.
This is Yannick Noah.
This is Ishitha from sunny Los Angeles, and you're listening to the Sensational Tennis Podcast.
Well, hello and welcome to the Tennis Podcast, and thank you there to Ishitha in sunny Los Angeles for introducing today's show that is brought to you from sunny Southwest London. Greetings from sunny Putney, also in sunny Southwest London. It's Matt Roberts. Hello, Matt.
Hello. I mean, we were in sunny Los Angeles about this time last year, weren't we? But I'm glad that the UK is at least delivering some much needed sun after weeks of rain.
You've got no idea, Matt, that Wimbledon Common is nothing but bog. It's going to have to be consistently dry and sunny for the next 5 months, I think, for Wimbledon Common to dry out. It's boggy and it's apparently heavily scattered with pretty heinous animal excrement that I've already had to wash out of Billie Jean's fur this morning. David, how are you doing? How's Solihull?
Very well. Very well, thank you. Solihull's very similar. You need to borrow one of those great big machines, don't you, that they push over the US Open Arthur Ashe Stadium to dry all of Wimbledon Common up. Or you could just use whatever actual Wimbledon tennis
David, the big machines. By big machines, do you mean children with towels and an occasional man with a leaf blower?
Yeah, but you know, back in the good old days, and like when they were really flush, they used to just, you know, have a big old, almost sort of one of those sitting on lawnmower types that they would drive about the place, and it would sort of dry it up. But yeah, they do seem to have regressed to the towels, and I don't think those are going to work on Wimbledon Common, sorry.
I'm not sure anything's going to work on Wimbledon Common. There are parts of it that are just pure lake. That they once were fields, they now are lakes. But anyway, that is my personal struggle. We've had a great week, haven't we? We've been hard at work. We had a live show for Friends of the Pod last Thursday. If you joined us for that, it was wonderful having you. It's still available on YouTube for Friends, or to listen to as a podcast for Friends if you missed it and would still like to. We were discussing and debating what we would change about tennis, and it was quite a long show, you'll be unsurprised to hear. We've got more stuff coming for Friends this month. On Thursday, we're going to be recording our next edition of Tennis Relived. That is about Ted Tingling. Matt did a tweet this week with just a teeny bit of a teaser for what's to come in the Ted Tingling show. It was a tasty old Friday night tweet, Matt.
I was having myself an evening reading Ted Tingling's book, 60 Years in Tennis, and getting all emotional at it. And I put up a little snippet, which people seem to like. And yeah, I'm really excited for that show. Ted Tingling is someone who has cropped up in so many of our Tennis Relived episodes. And I really see him now as just someone who has ushered tennis through history and is a real connecting point to so many of the game's biggest names. So really excited to sort of dig into his life and tell his story. I've learned a lot already, and yeah, I'm looking forward to recording that one.
Yeah, David's been doing lots of interviews for that show. Ted Tingling, of course, the man who designed Billie Jean King's dress for the Battle of Sexes and just played an enormous part in the building and marketing of the WTA Tour, particularly in its early days, and just an all-around fascinating man. So head to Matt's Twitter just for a little teaser of that show. We'll be recording it and it'll be up for Friends on Thursday. We also have our March live show for Friends coming up later this month. That'll be a Q&A show. We've got Hannah's third column coming later this month, and it is this month that we intend to launch our community space exclusively for Friends of the Tennis Podcast, a safe place to talk about tennis and build and make connections. Well, that's what we're hoping it'll be. And yeah, we're really excited about it. So it's a big month for Friends. And if you'd like to be a part of it all, you can become a friend for just £5 per month or £50 a year, or you can pay a bit more for a shout out or an intro. And the link to do it is, of course, in our show notes. Or you can go to tennis.supportingcast.fm and we would be thrilled to have you. We also, of course, for every listener, we will be doing our post-Indian Wells show live streamed on YouTube. This is something new for 2024. We're going to be doing it after, for our weekly podcast, after all combined 1,000 events. So Indian Wells, obviously the first of those of the year. It gets underway later this week. The draws are being done tonight as we come to you on early afternoon on Monday. So we'll have a little look ahead to that at the end of the show. But let's start by looking back, and let's start in the same place that we started last week, in Dubai. This time they've been hosting the men's 500 event all week, and the champion is a man that has never lost an ATP final in six attempts now. Hugo Humbert continued his incredible year. He beat Alexander Bublik 6-4, 6-3 in the final. Also scored wins incredibly over Daniil Medvedev in the semi-final. What a win over that. What a win over Medvedev that was. Andy Murray continues his run of losing to eventual champions Germán Fis and Hubert Hurkacz as well. He saved match points to beat Hubert Hurkacz. He is, David Law, some player.
he is. And that record of 6-0, I mean, we discussed it a few weeks ago when it was 5-0, was really taken by that statistic, because that is not an accidental statistic. That is not something that's just happened by chance. You have to be someone who can just put aside whatever nerves you feel, or deal with those nerves and have them elevate you in order to frequently, and in fact unfailingly, produce your best in the final and win. And that's what he's done again. And it was, I watched all of that final against Alexander Bublik, who comes in and he puts different types of pressure on you to probably all of the other players he's beaten in those five other finals. And he just sort of handles it all. He just looks really serene when he's out there, and he has no problem playing his own game. That's what so many people say they want to be able to do. I just want to play my game in the big moments and in a final. And we've had first time appearances in big finals this week from certain players, and real question marks over how they'd handle it. But Humbert seems to get better. It's a bit Świątek-like in that way. And you contrast that to, remember back when Felix Auger-Aliassime had the complete opposite result, record in finals for such a long time. And it's a big question mark against a player. The question mark against Humbert is, can he keep on turning up at tournaments and getting himself into position? Well, we've had a month of it, and he's at a career high ranking, and he really does look very, very good.
Yeah, Matt, sometimes stats are just quirky and interesting, but a little, you know, throwaway, there today, gone tomorrow. Sometimes stats tell you something very meaningful and significant about a player. And I do feel like this 6 out of 6 finals won for Hugo Humbert is in the meaningful and significant category.
I think so, especially given that he also did this on the Challenger Tour. You know, all levels of his career, he's had a very good performance in finals. I think the fact that he shares this record with two other players in terms of 6-0 is perhaps slightly going against our argument here, because the players he shares that record with are Ernest Gulbis and Martin Kližan. The only two other players to have gone 6-0 in their first 6 ATP finals since those sort of stats were collected. If he wins his next one, he will be the first player to ever win all 7 of his first 7 ATP finals. So I think it is telling in Humbert's case. There does seem to be a really impressive levelling up when he gets to the latter stages of tournaments, as David says, and not just in finals, actually. He's actually got a very good record against top 10 players, generally. I think he might even have a winning record against top 10 players in his career. So, you know, he's really stepping up in big matches. And the one I watched really closely this week was the Medvedev match. And Medvedev has reportedly come up with a list. Did you see this? He's come up with a list of 16 players.
16. Mm. And he's handed it to his new coach, Gilles Simon. It's like when you start with a new gym instructor, a new PT, and they say, what are your goals? And you're like, I'd like rock hard abs. Daniil Medvedev with like rock hard ability to beat Hugo Humbert.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, I would love to know who these 16 players are. I mean,
well, that's a show we can do, isn't
yeah.
it? Guessing, speculating about who the 16 players are.
It's possible they're just the top 16 ranked French players, because he always has trouble against French players. But Hugo Humbert for sure is on this list.
Gilles, help me with Benjamin Bonzi. I'll pay you anything.
Why is that? It's so interesting.
But like, Humbert has to be near the top of this list. He really does have Medvedev's number. He's beaten him 3 times out of 4. And Medvedev wasn't quite himself this tournament. His serve speed was down all tournament. It did seem like maybe he was struggling a little bit, obviously coming off that brutal Australian Open. He said that he decided to take his time and not rush back. But, you know, he won some matches. He obviously maintained his curse of not being able to defend the title. And it was Humbert who beat him, and beat him pretty convincingly and just so impressively. Every time I watch Humbert, I feel like I'm further impressed by him. He's got such compact swings, and yet he can generate real power. He hits it down the line incredibly well. We talked last time about the fact that his titles have come indoors, where he's now won an outdoor title. He's just consistently proving himself, and level-wise, he's right there, I think, with a real crop of players who have had big slam results, which is something that he hasn't had yet. You know, sort of Tommy Paul is a Grand Slam semi-finalist, and Ben Shelton is a Grand Slam semi-finalist, and Karen Khachanov. And I think the level Humbert's displaying right now is right there with those. And I think that's kind of the next step, isn't it? Trying to take this incredible form to some even bigger events. But he's a good watch, he's good fun, and I'm pleased that he's carrying on this good form.
Yeah, I approached my brother, who's somewhat of an Hugo Humbert connoisseur, and has been for months now trying to tempt me into taking Humbert in various different predictions competitions, and I've by and large resisted. But he obviously knew something that I didn't, and I wanted to ask him, like, has this always been in the post, this kind of form from Humbert? Have you just been sitting waiting for the day that you can say I told you so to all of us doubters? And he said, he kind of said yes, like it's more of a mystery to him that he hasn't been doing this up until now than that he is doing it now. He says my brother dabbles a bit in tennis data, and he says that the data shows he's had a massive spike in serve quality since November 2023. But he also said, my brother's got a new baby and a job, but somehow he's got time to deep dive on the on the life story of Hugo Humbert. But he said that he had a lot of injuries at a very sort of formative in his teenage years. And he actually, as a 15-year-old, he had an injury that put him on the sidelines for 18 months. And that's, you know, that's a very critical developmental age. And I do think, you know, although that was a while ago now, what is he? He's 24, 25? That was a while ago now, but I still think those things can just sort of generally have quite a significant impact on your career. So, look, I like watching him. I know he leaves some people cold. I'm not naming any names here, but I like that feeling of I don't know which way he's going to hit the ball when the ball comes to him. I really feel like on both wings it could go cross court, it could go down the line, and I'm like, oh, what could he do here? And I suppose part of that is I haven't watched loads of Hugo Humbert tennis. I'm watching more of it now than I ever have, and I'm sure I'll get used to it and get a little bit of a feel of what he's more likely to do at any given time. But I always like that when I'm watching a player, and I'm won over, and cue me starting to predict him doing stuff and his form,
yeah,
his form promptly dropping off a cliff. But Matt, you've convinced me. You convinced me of your noodle-armed European. His words, not mine.
I think when you were explaining that why you like watching him, Catherine, it struck me that the players that he comes up against are the opposite. They don't like playing against him. Top players, I think, fear him a bit because of the unknown. They don't quite know how to formulate the game plan that guarantees victory, you know, and which I think most top players, they will usually work you out. And there's something about him that is difficult to work out. And therefore, as a viewing experience, when he draws somebody, I mean, I often end up quite frustrated by him because I don't feel like the results have matched up to that locker room aura a little bit that he's developed for himself, the fear factor. And now, suddenly, with these two titles in a month, maybe this is it. Maybe this is the moment that Hugo Humbert starts to deliver results to go with that aura that he's got.
The other thing I would say is he's really comfortable on grass in a way that so few are. He's won Halle. He's had I feel like possibly Wimbledon might have been his most successful slam, or certainly equal most successful slam. I've got a vague memory of him sort of challenging Djokovic there, certainly playing him tough at Wimbledon.
A long
really
time
I
ago.
Plucked that up. Yeah.
Pre-pandemic,
exactly.
When he, I think.
You know, right.
When Djokovic played him and Hurkacz back to back, I think.
Very good. Thank you for fleshing out my extremely fuzzy memory there. Really, that was teamwork. But yeah, like, that is not a crowded field. Players that are comfortable on grass. That, I mean, he could cue vague predictions. He could do something big. Wimbledon, I think. Humbert, the champion. Bublik, the finalist. We got to talk about how Bublik reached that final via a disqualification in his semi-final of his opponent, Andrei Rublev. Now, this was for an incident that many of you will have either seen live or seen doing the rounds on social media because of the subsequent disqualification, it caused quite a bit of a stir. Basically, there was a line call that Rublev very strongly disagreed with, and he expressed this very aggressively in the face of the baseline line judge that was, well, at the time, meters from him, but he approached the line judge and was really very close to him, gesturing and shouting in his face. Now, it seemed at the time that what he was disqualified for was specifically what he shouted to the line judge. The line judge reported what was shouted to the umpire. He said he was shouting in Russian. The line judge spoke Russian and was able to translate it and reported it. as being something that warranted, in the view of the umpire, an immediate disqualification. So the understanding there is that the disqualification was for what was said rather than the way it was is said. And Rublev took massive issue with that because he's absolutely adamant that he didn't say whatever he was accused of saying, and he indeed wasn't even speaking in Russian, which I can't confirm or deny, and I haven't seen anybody else that's been able to categorically confirm whether he was speaking in Russian, what he might have said. Personally, I think that's a bit of a red herring, what he was saying rather than the way he was saying it, which I think is what's at issue here. But it is critical that if that's what he was disqualified for, then there perhaps is grounds for appeal. And on that matter, we've been in touch with the ATP on that, whose head of corporate communications, Simon Higson, has sent us the following statement. He says, the ATP has reviewed an appeal from Andrei Rublev following the player's default from the semi-finals of the ATP 500 tournament in Dubai. The appeal process took into consideration testimonies from the player, officials, as well as reviews of all available video and audio materials. The appeals committee concluded that beyond forfeiting the match, customary penalties associated with a default, namely loss of ranking points and prize money for the entire tournament, would be disproportionate in this case. As such, Rublev retained semi-final points and prize money for the tournament. A fine of $36,400 for the code violation still remains. What do we think about all of this, David?
Well, I think that his shouting in the face of the line judge really was a problem for me, and it's not the first time. He's done it a few times, and I actually think something needed to be happened, a stand needed to be taken against that. That's one thing. That's the first immediate reaction that I have as somebody who just doesn't like, I just don't like seeing that. And I don't want to see line judges or chair umpires exposed to that. Now, the counter to that is that, A, we're now at a stage where really line calling shouldn't involve line judges. A lot of people are saying, well, if there hadn't been line judges because of Hawkeye, then you wouldn't have had that. Well, I've still seen him climb the stairs of a chair umpire, admittedly in Ultimate Tennis Showdown, so I don't think that counts. But anyway, he's still climbed the stairs of a chair umpire's chair to shout in the face of the umpire one time, it's just got to stop. I don't care how annoyed you are, how wronged you are, you just shouldn't be doing that. That's just not appropriate behaviour. But then this has been a bit of a cock-up, really, a mess-up from the authorities and from the chair umpire and the referee and the supervisor to get to this set of punishments in the first place. And so there's two wrongs there, and I think that they've probably done the right thing ultimately in their review of the situation, so that there is still a fine, but that it isn't everything.
Yeah, like as soon as Rublev got in that line judge's face and started shouting at him and waving his racket at him, I immediately didn't like that. And I would be perfectly fine for tennis to have a blanket rule that said that kind of behavior gets you a disqualification. I think there's sort of two issues though here, is that one, tennis hasn't had a zero tolerance on that sort of behavior before. It has let similar aggressions go in the past. So I think anyone who saw this and thought that was the reason why Rublev got the default, they probably thought that it seemed overly harsh. But actually, as you said, the reason for the default was verbal abuse. That was the official reason given. And the issue here is that the process seems not quite satisfactory, really, because you're taking the word of the official who was sitting next to the line judge who was shouted at, and that person's word counts above Rublev's, and there was no checking of the tape in the moment whatsoever. And you know, looking at the video, it does seem that he's speaking some sort of mix of Russian and English. It's very unclear. And I think a lot of people have looked at that video and still been left unclear. You know, we see that all the time with video review in sport. You think it's going to clear everything up, and it doesn't necessarily totally do that. But it did seem like the process was not quite right. It did seem like maybe they needed to, you know, consider some video before defaulting him. And then if you can't determine from that video in the moment, then you take the word of the official, I suppose. But it did all seem a little bit harsh for Rublev. But at the same time, as I said, I don't think you can be behaving like that. And I'd be happy if there was a blanket rule where that sort of behavior was an immediate default, no matter what you said. If you're saying something that aggressively in someone's face, I don't think you can have too many complaints if you're defaulted. And yeah, I think the wider Rublev issue here is that a lot of the time his anger is inward, isn't it? But there have been a few occasions recently where it's been aimed more at other people as well. And he needs to get those issues kind of under control. And I think the fact that it's Rublev, who everyone likes, you know, people have been perhaps a little more lenient and sort of generous towards him. But, you know, if this were other players, I think people really would have been talking about sort of Rublev's outburst towards officials longer ago. It does feel like he's maybe had this coming a little bit, and hopefully he can learn from it. And you know, I'm sure he will.
Yeah, this is certainly how I felt about it anyway, slightly sort of disappointing and distasteful outpouring of resentment and belittling of officials and officialdom from fellow players on social media in response to this, wasn't there, David?
Yeah, there was. And I understand why they club together and they are frustrated in their own instances. They've all got examples where they feel like they've been harshly treated, and they know how hard it is out on the court in a way that we can't know. I do understand that. But at the same time, that doesn't excuse this sort of behaviour. It's not okay. It's not all right to be going up and shouting in somebody's face like that, who's just trying to do their job. Maybe they've got it wrong. Maybe they've made a mistake. Well, you make mistakes all the time as tennis players. And if somebody behaved like that to you, you'd be offering them outside, or you'd be reporting them. You wouldn't just put up with it.
Well, you'd be sacked on the spot, in a workplace.
Yeah, you just can't be doing it. And I was sorry that there wasn't somebody, some former player or some current player who didn't come out and say, hold on a minute, yes, this might have been a bit of a mess up in the instance, but let's not say that this behaviour is okay as a response to it. It's not.
No, and there's such a disparity in power and platform between tennis players and officials. I mean, officials, I presume, aren't allowed to sort of speak publicly about players and their role and decisions. And even if they did, no one would take any notice. I don't think I follow that line judge on Twitter, if they have a Twitter account, but I do follow all the players that were speaking out to slag off officialdom, and that it just didn't feel right to me. And yeah, I think the fact of it being Andrei Rublev really muddies how everybody sees the whole issue, because he's such a nice guy. I mean, honestly, you couldn't meet a more kind of gentle, you couldn't meet a less aggressive seeming human being. And you know, it's that red mist that comes over tennis players in the heat of battle, and I get that that's something we can never understand. But also, I don't think the answer is to just give carte blanche to behaviours and to not expect tennis players to exert any self control, even in the most heated of conditions. I mean, what are we doing if we give in to that? Okay, so that is Dubai taken care of, unless anybody has any other Dubai-based business. We'll move on to Acapulco, another ATP 500 event, won for the second time by Alex de Minaur. Defending his title, he beat Casper Ruud 4-4 in the final. And perhaps even more significantly, he finally beat Stefanos Tsitsipas at the 11th time of asking. I watched quite a bit of this final on catch up this morning, actually, Matt, and I just can't believe how good Alex de Minaur is, quite frankly. He's just so goddamn good now.
He is, yeah. He's become, well, you know, a sort of top 10 player, really, and he belongs there. I used to look at his draws and think, well, there's probably going to be someone who can manhandle him a bit. You know, he's always had incredible foot speed, but you know, he would often run into someone who just hit the ball bigger and was able to, yeah, just sort of dominate him a little bit. But those players who are capable of doing that, their numbers are really dwindling, because he has sort of figured out a way of imposing his own game a lot more. And also, he's still got that great defensive ability as well. You know, he can beat you in sort of different ways now. And that's a massive deal, I think, that he beat Tsitsipas. You know, a 0-10 record is not a small problem. That's pretty catastrophic, really. And yet, the way that their last few months have been going, you know, they've been going in totally different directions. And if de Minaur had still been unable to beat Tsitsipas, and he lost the first set of this one 6-1, you know, handily, he wasn't playing well. If he'd then lost, you would have thought that maybe it doesn't undo a lot of the good work that de Minaur's done in the last few months. But it, you know, it just carries that little question mark still. And yet, you know, he turned that match around very impressively. I think winning in Acapulco is a lot to do with coping with the conditions as well. And he showed that he could do that last year. You know, it was incredibly hot and sweaty last year. I remember Taylor Fritz ended up on a drip after that tournament, and yet de Minaur sort of came through it unscathed. And I always felt like he can handle those conditions in Acapulco, and he did all week. And against Casper Ruud in the final, one of the things that I picked out was that de Minaur serve that we've spoken about so much as in terms of having improved. I felt like Ruud didn't know how to return it. He didn't know whether to stand back. But if he did, he would sort of give up so much the court. And de Minaur now is so good at stepping in and taking the ball early. So then Ruud tried stepping in a few times himself. But, you know, it's a good serve now, de Minaur's. You can't attack it all that easily. And that wasn't really working for Ruud either. So, yeah, like, credit to Alex de Minaur. He has improved his game so much. And it's great to see. And he's now in a place where he is barely defending any points whatsoever until Queens. You know, he did nothing really on the clay last year. He lost his first match at both Indian Wells and Miami. There's a real opportunity here in the form that he's in for him to, you know, keep climbing those rankings. And I think he's already three in the race this year. Like, it's really impressive.
Clay's kind of a free hit for him, isn't it? I mean, I don't think he's... I actually think he's quite comfortable on clay, isn't he? I mean, he lives and trains in Spain a lot of the year, spent a lot of time, you know, he's got Spanish heritage, and I think he's comfortable on that. I just don't think his game is necessarily particularly suited to it. So, yeah, it kind of feels like everything over the next few months will be a bonus. And then, again, he can be seriously dangerous on the grass, I think. But this aggression and weaponry, David, combined with how compact his game is, it just doesn't feel like there's anything that can be picked on by opponents. It doesn't feel like there's anything that's going to break down or go wrong. Yes, there's a crop of players that can overwhelm him. And as Matt said, that crop is dwindling, but that will still exist. But I don't think you can pick him apart at all.
No, I didn't see this coming. If you'd have asked me a year ago, who do you think's going to get into the top 10, and he had been on that list, I would have been I'd have been pretty surprised, and I'd have been even more surprised to have seen him not only back up getting into the top 10, but to be hurting people the way he is right now. Like Tsitsipas, like turning that match around, like playing Casper Ruud tough and beating him 6-4, 6-4. I know Ruud's had a pretty long week and a good week, but Dimonor steps up to the line now, really backing himself. And yes, there are a couple of players that if they play lights out, he probably still is going to get overwhelmed. But yeah, dwindling is a good word to use for that pool of players that is going to do that to him. And I'm really pleased for him because he's the absolutely perfect professional and competitor, isn't he? He just gives you everything, both on and off court, every time. And I mean, car, if you were his coach and Leighton Hewitt, you can see the pride in Leighton Hewitt's eyes when he watches him play. And I understand why.
Yeah, I think he makes Leighton Hewitt feel like his own career is he's been able to live his dreams and never retire.
you wait till Dimonor starts playing doubles in about 2 years' time.
It's such a shame to me that Acapulco is in such a dodgy time zone for us, because it does seem to produce good tennis, doesn't it? Like, I just associate it with drama and good matches, and, you know, Middle and South America, they get great crowds. Ben Shelton played a lot of fun tennis this week. I enjoyed seeing Jack Draper have a good week until he puked and didn't have a Jannik Sinner experience after it. In fact, left the court in his semi-final looking positively green. But yeah, it was just there was a lot of fun stuff this week, I thought, Matt.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, Shelton played these three epics really against Evans, Arnaldi and Ruud. They were all three setters, and he just suited the vibe of that tournament perfectly. I hope Shelton goes back to Acapulco every year, because that's a sort of marriage of player and tournament that really works, I think. Draper, it sounded like Draper was kind of a bit under the weather all week, and yet he was winning matches very convincingly, barely dropping games. He had a very good win against Tommy Paul and against Kecmanovic, but just sort of ran out of gas eventually against Alex de Minaur in the semis when he was really feeling unwell. And another good week for Casper Ruud, as David said. You know, I think he'll be disappointed that he's not won one of these two finals in Mexico. You know, he's reached back-to-back finals there and lost to Jordan Thompson and Alex de Minaur. You know, I think he's making really good strides again on hard courts, as we said. But I did think he was a little lost of how to play Alex de Minaur in that final. He just didn't get his aggression under control. I felt like he was really trying to hit his forehand huge all the time, and yet it wasn't really working, which maybe is just credit to Alex de Minaur and how he felt like he couldn't sort of outlast him, so he had to outhit him, but that's not easy these days. It was a really really fun tournament, and you know, honestly, good for the, like, it was good that the event was even able to be staged after the devastating hurricane that they had, like, and I think the ATP did some outreach efforts as well, and Tsitsipas, I know, was donating prize money from his aces and that sort of thing, and hopefully that tournament can just sort of continue to rebuild again, because it's a great stop on the calendar.
Yeah, pretty astonishing actually that they were able to stage that tournament as successfully as they were. Mischievous question for you both: who in the future is more likely to reach a Grand Slam final, Casper Ruud or Alex de Minaur?
That's a great question. I'm going to go de Minaur. And I know that I always do this to Casper Ruud. I always sell him short. And, you know, he's the guy who's reached two of them. Three of them. Three Grand Slam finals. Three of them. And I'm not even putting him ahead of Alex de Minaur.
That's why it's a good question, that? David. I'm very pleased with it.
It's a great question, Catherine. I don't know. What do you think, Matt?
I think Ruud at the French Open is the single most likely one out of those, I would say.
Yeah. let's ask Catherine. Then she can't keep posing great questions and not answering them. What do you think, Catherine?
I'm torn. I had exactly the same thought. Like, big picture, it just feels like the answer is de minaur. But boiling it down to individual, you know, putting myself in a position of doing pre-tournament predictions on the eve of a Grand Slam, sitting down with a draw, I think I'm more likely to put Casper Ruud in a French Open final than I am to write Alex de Minaur's name on a draw sheet in any other final. But I think it's pretty close. And again, that's why it's such a good question.
And there's also the unknown of, like, how much more can de Minaur keep improving? Like, I still think he's on his upward trajectory. Like, I don't necessarily... He might have peaked. This might be as good as his game ever gets. But equally, he's improved so much in the past few months, he might keep improving. You know, if he starts beating Jannik Sinner, you know, a few times, I might change my answer there. But, you know, experience is a lot, and doing it at slams, and Ruud has done it three times, I think that's hard to ignore.
Humbert de Minaur Wimbledon final?
Sign me up.
Could happen.
I'll tell you, there's definitely some results that have gone on the last few weeks. You know, I complained the other day on the live show about how much tennis there's been in February, but actually what there has also been is a lot of winners that I'm now looking forward to following the future and the kind of fortunes of, particularly in Indian Wells and Miami.
Is one of those Sebastian Baez, David?
Not there. I'm more interested in him in Europe on clay.
Just going to cover off Sebastian Baez winning the event in Santiago, beating Alejandro Tabilo in the final, a dashing Chilean hopes of a home champion. There was a moment when Baez was serving for the match in the third set, 3-6, it's love 6-4 it was in the end, where I thought the comeback was on for Tabilo and the crowd were going absolutely bananas and I was loving it. But it wasn't to be. Baez stood up for it. Were you watching that too, Matt?
Well, I was just, yes. And I was just going to say that, like, Baez this month is very much giving Christian Garin 2020 before the pandemic, because Garin won Cordoba and Rio and ended up really high in the race, and then COVID struck, and Baez has won Rio and Santiago and is currently six in the race. And, like, he's won, I think he's won more matches than anyone on tour this year, and yet, you know, he's not actually had to beat the sort of opponents that Alex de Minaur and Hugo Humbert, for example, have been beating. But he is racking up the wins, and he is a very, very good clay court player. And, you know, that match David always references from Roland Garros a couple of years ago, where he probably should have beaten Alexander Zverev. In this form, he's just a player that all the top seeds, I think, will want to avoid at Roland Garros on the clay.
Okay, so stock back up on those FFP FFP2 masks, everyone. Is what Matt seems to be saying there. Oh, great. God. I think I've still got some left over from the last pandemic. We need to rattle through this, I'm afraid, because there's still so much tennis still to talk about. But I would like to spare a moment to talk about Corentin Moutet versus all of Chile. Who would like to take the floor on this one?
I was addicted to it, Catherine. I've got to go first. I mean, so somebody drew my attention to the fact that he'd done an underarm serve in the first point of the match against Nicolas Jarry on Twitter. And I did not know this match was taking place. And I heard about this, and I just ended up going and watching the whole thing as a result. And, I mean, I've never seen anything quite like that before. I mean, you know, crowd's getting wild. They finally settle down. First point of the match, underarm serve, ace, drop shot winner. And he's immediately whistled. And he just walks off with a swagger. And he ends up winning the match on two tiebreak sets. And at the handshake, from what I understand, I mean, Nicolas Jarry told him he was pathetic. And Moutet, having been called this, basically re-invited him to come to the net to repeat it, and then walked off with his arms raised as emphatically as they possibly could be with the crowd. And it doesn't come across on TV quite as well as when they really do a close-up on the crowd and show just how angry and vitriolic they were getting, because he was winding them up so much. And this was a packed Chilean crowd supporting a Chilean, and here he is in their face doing the Djokovic heart to the crowd celebration in their faces. I mean, it was just epic. And then he comes out and he plays another Chilean in the final, in the semi-final in Alejandro Tabilio, and he's a set and one love up. And again, they're just getting so angry about it. And then his game just completely disappears and he loses 11 points in a row, goes one set all. He then goes a break of serve up in the third set. He looks like he's absolutely got it nailed on for the win. And then Tabilio actually comes and plays some brilliant tennis. I mean, he has got a really lively forehand to wrestle it off him. And at the end, it was just sort of, it was as though I think the Chileans, they hate him, but they love to hate him. You know, they were, I think they were loving every minute of it. And he was loving every minute.
Favorite thing. It's giving Medvedev US Open 2019, isn't it?
Yeah. I was so pleased to see Mute back and actually able to play like that, because he's had a lot of injury problems, and you know, he's a great addition.
Mm. Yeah. Thank you, David. You did that. That joy, great justice. We move on to San Diego and the WTA 500 tournament there, won by Britain's Katie Bolter, her second career title, her first at 500 level. She beat Marta Kostyuk 5-7, 6-2, 6-2 in the final. She was watched on by Alex de Minaur, her boyfriend, who had foregone the famous Acapulco post-tournament party in order to fly to San Diego in order to see Katie Bolter in the final. They are an official power couple now, having won tandem 500 titles. I watched a lot of Katie Bolter this week. I have to say, the final was by far the worst. I don't think every one of her matches. I watched her semi-final. I watched her match against Donna Vekic. I mean, the final, I have to say, pretty horrible quality. I think it was pretty windy. It was a double fault fest on both sides of the net. Marta Kostyuk won the opening set, and then her form just absolutely dropped off a cliff. She looked kind of exhausted. She just looked utterly drained. It looked like winning that first set was all she had left to give, and it was such a scrappy match. I think those matches just require so much brain capacity and concentration, don't they? It just felt like she had nothing left in the tank after that first set. But I was so impressed with the fact that Katie Bolter won the final, given it was that kind of match, because the performance she put in the semi-final against Emma Navarro was so completely different. It was the ultimate purple patch performance. It was just, every time the ball went to her racket, I felt like it was going to be a winner. Didn't know where, it could have been either wing, could have been down the line, could have been cross court. Everything she touched turned to gold. You know, your proverbial seeing the ball like a melon or a football. And this was, there was a rain delay mid-match in this one. And I really feared for her after that, because it just felt like such a kind of being in a bubble type situation. I thought it can't possibly resume in the same way, right? I felt like something had to change, but somehow she comes back out on court and she still, honestly, her racket was like a magic wand. It was unbelievable ball striking. And watching the first set of this final against Marta Kostyuk and how scrappy and messy it was, I thought, I really worried for her, because it was just such a different match to the matches that had got her there. And I actually think it's more impressive for her to have won that title in a scrap than for her to have just continued in a purple patch. I always think it's good and impressive when players win matches in lots of different ways. And I think that's particularly good for the confidence. I do think she is a confidence player. It'd be interesting to see if she can carry this into Indian Wells, where absolutely nobody is going to want to draw her. I know on paper it sounds quite similar, doesn't it? San Diego to Indian Wells, you're staying in the same state, it's hard courts, but you know, we all know how unique the conditions are in Indian Wells. It's not a given that lead up success leads to success. in Indian Wells, but I loved watching her. I loved watching her, and I think it's just an enormous week. And she's 27 years old, Katie Bolter. 27. This is late bloomer territory, and I know she's had a lot of injury interruption, but it really snuck up on me her being in her late 20s now, and I'm pleased for her because she just seems in such a good place. I was staying in the same hotel as Team GB and Team Australia in Perth this year at the United Cup, and Katie Bolter was definitely part of a very good vibe with Team GB, but she was also very much embedded in Team Australia as well. And I saw her having breakfast most mornings with Alex de Minaur and with Team Australia, and I just thought, God, it just seemed like a really healthy, well-adjusted vibe, and that's pretty notable in tennis. And I'm really pleased that that is sort of translating into tennis results, because I want that to be something that's conducive to success, because so often we talk about kind of success being at odds with having any kind of healthy, well-adjusted existence. But they just seem in such a good place, and I'm thrilled for them both.
Yeah, me too. And that point there about whether she can keep it going in Indian Wells, I mean, she has given herself a slight helping hand there, because she's going to be seeded at Indian Wells. You know, her ranking has jumped so much that she'll be seeded, and that means she doesn't have to start until Friday or Saturday, because the draw is not till today. So they use this week's rankings, whereas most events use the rankings from the week before. But she has at least, you know, she will use the points that she's earned in San Diego to get her position in that Indian Wells draw. So that's, you know, potentially helpful. And honestly, I'm so impressed with what she's done since winning Nottingham last year, where honestly I was probably a little bit skeptical as to whether that would mean anything whatsoever. You know, if you just took that tournament in isolation, that was a win on grass in front of her home crowd, but it was kind of like a national tournament almost. She beat four Brits along the way to win that title, and no one that she played, I think, was ranked higher than about 120 in the world. You know, it was a big deal, a first WTA title, but what would it actually sort of mean in the long run? And it gave her ranking that little boost inside the top 80, and she has taken that and absolutely ran with it. You know, she reached the third round at Wimbledon and the US Open off the back of that, had good qualifying performances in Beijing and Montreal last year, started this season so well, beating Jessica Pegula and then losing to the eventual finalist at the Australian Open in Jung Chin Wen. She beat tough draw Jasmine Paolini the other week in Linz, and didn't then play the Middle East swing. You know, came back here, had a training block to prepare herself for this US swing. So it just seems like she's making a lot of really smart decisions. She's got this run of fitness, as you said. She had that terrible back injury for so long. She's hopefully that's now past her. And like, the game's better than it used to be as well. She's moving better. There's more intensity in her footwork, I think. And she's got a bit more margin on her shots without actually having lost any of the power either. And it's all just really coming together for her. And I'm pleased. I've never really doubted the game quite so much. It's more the sort of grit and the resilience, and I think what you're speaking about there in terms of how well adjusted she seems to be, I imagine it is easier to decide to, you know, that you need to go to places in that you don't necessarily want to go to play tennis if you're sort of feeling happier with tour life generally. And it's really great to see, and kind of excited about what her ceiling could be now.
Yeah, it's such a easy analysis on her game. Like, when she's in position to hit both the forehand and the backhand, they are brilliant shots. She just needed to be in position more often, be in optimum position more often. And she's improved her footwork and her speed and her movement such that it feels to me like she's in position to hit those shots about sort of 25% more of the time, which is massive, isn't it? And David, both she and Marta Kostyuk, both finalists in San Diego, coached by women. And I wish that weren't notable, but it is, you know, it is incredibly notable. Biljana Veselinovic, coach of Katie Bolter, and Sandra Zaniewska, coach of Marta Kostyuk. It's just, yeah, it's just brilliant. Just good news story.
It is. And actually, they both gave quite similar interviews last year talking about the benefits they found by working with women and just, I guess, feeling a little more understood, a little communication, a little more easy to come by in certain areas where they needed it. And I just, listen, you're right. It's a shame that we have to talk about it as a story, but it is one, because it's unusual, really, on the whole. And they are just examples of how there's no reason why this can't work. And actually, there are definite benefits, no question about it, for a woman to be coached by a woman and to be surrounded by women in their professional working lives on the tennis circuit. And just also a very final note, just on Kostyuk, who spoke incredibly movingly on court at the end of this one about the struggles the last few days in particular in Ukraine and her concerns for her family and how motivated she is to keep doing well for them and to give them something to smile about. And my admiration for her is just immense. And she is putting together a bloody impressive career at the same time. And, you know, wish her luck too.
Yeah, and you can see the weight that she's playing with. It is sort of constantly at the forefront, and it's absolutely extraordinary what she's doing. Last event to cover from last week, WTA 250 in Austin, the first all-Chinese final to take place outside of Asia since 2006, when Zheng Jie defeated Li Na to take the title in Estoril, Portugal. This one was Yuan Nui beating Wang Jiyu 6-4, 7-6 in the final to win her first WTA title. So pretty incredible. And what a crop of Chinese players there are on the women's side. And I know that there's a crop on the men's side as well, but it just feels like the pool and the women's side is, you know, there's proper depth to it now.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass?
So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Hello, Tennis Podcast listeners. David here. Now, you might know that I love a bit of cooking, and I think I'm quite good at it. But if I'm honest, even I get fed up trying to work out what to do every night. That's where Home Chef comes in. Being able to put together a delicious meal without the long prep and the cook times, well, that's pretty cool. Home Chef provides fresh ingredients and chef-designed recipes conveniently delivered to your doorstep to simplify your cooking experience. They have over 30 options a week and serve a variety of dietary needs, so you don't have to worry about what to make ahead of time. Not only is it convenient, but it's economical too. Home Chef customers save an average of $86 per month on groceries. Now, for a limited time, Home Chef is offering Tennis Podcast listeners 18 free meals plus free dessert for life and, of course, free shipping on your very first box. Go to homechef.com/tennis. That's homechef.com/tennis for 18 free meals and free dessert for life. You heard it right.
We had news this, I mean, it feels like we always have news, don't we? But we had a few bits of significant news in the tennis world this week. Andy Murray, after losing to Hugo Humbert in Dubai, gave some quotes about his potential retirement. Not necessarily hugely surprising quotes, but maybe surprising to hear him talk about it so revealingly just now. He said, he basically said, I'm likely not going to play past the summer. And he's obviously not taking anything for granted, re the Olympics and being selected to play the Olympics, although I think he's a shoo-in for a World Cup, being a two-time former gold medalist, but or even being fit for the Olympics, I think is perhaps the bigger concern. But it sounds to me like he is targeting the Olympics in Paris as his end point, David.
Mm. And I mean, that would be fitting. There are a number of places I think that would be fitting. Wimbledon, obviously, the US Open, having won his first Grand Slam title there, would be fitting. Anywhere is fitting, really, isn't it, for a career like Andy Murray's had. I am taking it with a pinch of salt, because I think if he were to play some decent tennis in any point over the next 3 or 4 months, I think he may well think, OK, I wanted to carry on. Now the results are happening. But I think he's so sick of being asked about it. And I totally understand why he's asked about it. Frankly, I've asked about it, and I would again if I was in a position where I felt it was necessary, because it is a journalistically relevant question for somebody who's of his age and has gone through what he has and has achieved what he has. But I also totally understand why he's just sick of having to think about it, when actually what he's wanted to do is just play the damn matches and try to get better. But yeah, it's going to be coming at some point, and they are notable words that he's now packaging in a sort of time scale of thinking, well, yeah, it's likely to be the summer, certainly the way things are going.
We had the not at all unexpected news this week that the ATP and PIF, the Saudi Public Investment Fund, have announced a multi-year strategic partnership to accelerate the growth of global tennis. It, according to the ATP press release, marks a significant shared commitment to enhancing global tennis. PIF now officially sponsor the ATP rankings. They are the PIF ATP rankings. So the ATP rankings is now officially sponsored by the Saudi Arabian state. Matt?
All the easy questions. Yeah, look, as you said, it had been coming. I think, you know, a lot of journalists had been reporting this for a while. I think it's yet more evident that the Saudi Public Investment Fund are going to try and work with tennis, you know, within the existing structures, rather than in a more sort of confrontational, direct challenge manner as they did in golf. I think it's quite interesting that the press release doesn't mention Saudi Arabia until the seventh paragraph. You know, obviously the public investment fund, if you know that that is Saudi Arabia, but there will be some people who might be reading that press release and don't know what the public investment fund is. It's kind of buried in there in the seventh paragraph. And there's also a line in there that the PIF will actively contribute to the ATP's One Vision strategic plan, which, as Simon Briggs wrote in his piece writing this up in The Telegraph, that is basically meaning that they're treated as a stakeholder within tennis's political game, basically. So there's definitely growing sort of influence for Saudi Arabia. It isn't just an injection of cash. There will be more sort of influence that they're having as well. And yeah, not unexpected, but it's difficult to shake the feeling that you get when you see this, that sort of human rights atrocities are sort of being ignored and there's no kind of bar which needs to be met in terms of social reform and sort of money rules, I suppose, at the end of the day.
Yeah. Yeah, pretty demoralizing, because genies don't go back in bottles on these things. I think, you know, we get asked a lot about why do you never talk about tennis taking place in Dubai and Doha when homosexuality is illegal in those locations as well as in Saudi Arabia, although Saudi Arabia do have other things going on as well that Dubai and Doha don't. Well, the genie's out of the bottle on those. You know, we weren't making podcasts at the time the leap was made to invite those places into the tennis world, which is why, you know, we don't cover it as a live topic. And I fear that in a few years' time that will be the case in Saudi Arabia, because I just don't see this stuff getting walked back once it's done, which is why it just feels so demoralizing. You know, yes, there'll be a bit of outcry, but the ATP and anybody else getting into bed with PIF and Saudi Arabia know that you can just ride that out. It'll be fine in the long run. Everyone will lose energy for it. Move on to the next thing to be demoralized about. And there we go. David, you kind of called this next bit of news. You said David Witt is not going to sit on the shelf as an untapped coaching talent for long. And so it seems he's received the call from Maria Sakkari. They are teaming up, player and coach. It's the perfect kind of player becomes available, coach becomes available. Oh, right. Player hand glove kind of situation.
Yeah, I mean, I think we probably reported the split of Sakkari and her coach and David Witt and Jessica Pegula at the same time, almost, you know. And I do find this a really fascinating one, because David Witt has worked with such different characters to Maria Sakkari in the past, in Venus Williams and Jessica Pegula, two very serene seeming characters who don't sort of lose the plot out there and don't, they just seem to have it under control. They might lose matches, but it's not going to be emotionally lost. And Sakkari does seem to struggle, frankly, to keep her composure sometimes when it really gets tight. And it's kind of what I love about her as well. I mean, she plays with such heart. How is he going to be able to influence her? And I'm just really interested in, is she going to be able to respond? Is she going to be able to buy in, listen, and actually benefit properly from it? I think it's one of the more interesting coaching appointments for a while.
Matt, your big Greek prediction, is it back on?
No. The problem is that was such a bad prediction, because it relied on two people doing well. Like, even if Sakkari gets back on track, we've got a whole Tsitsipas situation. So
yeah, Tsitsipas can't even beat Dimonor anymore. So
did they both have to win a Grand Slam? Is that what was going on? Oh god.
Yeah. In the same year.
I only always bring it up because you have the fewest terrible predictions, Matt.
Yeah,
I'm not, they're not always right, but you don't embarrass yourself very often.
Yeah, we had to search quite hard, didn't we, Catherine, on the tennis podcast worst ever predictions compilation.
Yeah, Matt's never used a phrase like foregone conclusion. He'd never be so reckless.
Only this once.
So yeah, I do cling to the big Greek prediction for the lols.
And she keeps bringing it up.
Last bit of news, and we are running a bit over time because that always seems to be the case when I'm at the helm. But we had the Netflix slam yesterday. Carlos Alcaraz against Rafael Nadal in an exhibition match taking place in Las Vegas, our neck of the woods. Matt, we went to Las Vegas before Rafael Nadal went to Las Vegas.
And in fact, the hotel they were at was the one that we went to post Taylor Swift concert to avoid the crowds.
I remember, we sort of sheltered in there. Yeah, it was
with our espresso martinis.
With espresso martini, I don't even like espresso martinis. I was just sort of like, it seems like the thing to do. So sure, yeah. David, you have the floor for 90 seconds to talk about the Netflix slam.
I have one take I'd like to get in after David, by the way.
Oh,
all right.
Whoever wants to go
David
first,
David should go first because mine's silly.
You have a combined 120 seconds. Go.
Okay, good. Well, I mean, I think the first thing to say is that when I raised the point that good news, folks, the Netflix slam is in our time zone because they've stuck it on at 8:30 p.m. UK time, which must be about lunchtime in Las Vegas. I got tumbleweed from you two. Both of you had got completely other plans and were saying you really weren't very interested in this match, and I, on the other hand, was just interested in it out of just sheer curiosity and to see what Las Vegas would do, to see what Netflix would do, to see what Andre Agassi would say. He was in the sort of on the desk, you know, in the studio alongside Andy Roddick. And honestly, I mean, I went to bed after the first set. And it really, the tennis wasn't great. I mean, I thought Nadal looked better than I expected. He said he felt better than he expected to feel. Alcaraz looked terrible at that stage. I've got to be honest. He looked like he was hardly cantering towards the ball, really. I mean, this is a guy who rolled his ankle 2 weeks ago, and Juan Carlos Ferreira said, you know, he's having to be careful. And I was watching it with my wife, and she says, what is this match? And I says, well, you know, let's be honest, I don't think we're going to end up with 6-2, 6-1, because you don't in these things. And sure enough, I woke up and it was 14-12 in the third. And so,
I'm not saying... What a surprise, Dave. Who could possibly have predicted that scoreline? I mean, astonishing.
I do think for the general Netflix surfer who may have stumbled on it, they want to get something that's exciting, even though I think it was not properly exciting from a... you once said about Laver Cup, I think, or one of these exhibitions. I think exhibitions generally, Catherine, they're just not for us. They're just not for people that are really massive tennis fans who are into the tour week in, week out in quite the same way. They're for people who don't really watch tennis, but, oh, Nadal, I've heard of him. Oh, Alcaraz. Oh, Las Vegas. Andre Agassi. Oh, I'll watch a bit of this. And you want it to be exciting. Hey, presto, it is. And maybe they get interested in tennis. But, it wasn't something that was holding my attention after the first set.
Right. And I totally do. I do believe that. Like, I can be as cynical about it as I like, but it's not for me. And it's not... I mean, I do have some misgivings about exhibition tennis happening during the main season, but I have misgivings about it happening in the off season as well. So, look, if it brings a new audience to tennis and gets people interested, it's pretty harmless. It is harmless. So, you know, good luck to them. I do have an issue with the misleading selling of it. Don't tell us how much the result of this matters to the two players. Don't tell us how high the stakes are for the two players. That is just willfully misleading. You know, I worked on the Champions Tour as the PR and communications person working for David for years. And I wouldn't have been a paying ticket holder for the Champions Tour. That wasn't aimed at me either. But, you know, when we used to write those press releases, David, I was always wary of not misleading, not trying to pretend it's some great contest that it isn't. When it's John McEnroe taking on someone 25 years younger than him, you know, I'll focus on a different angle if the tennis is obviously scripted or choreographed or not genuine or whatever. And that element of it does bother me. Like, it's a show and that's fine. Like, for some people, that's all they want to see. They just want to see these guys and see them in the flesh and see their physicality and stuff. And, you know, the intense competitiveness of it isn't important to them, and that is completely fine. But don't try and have it both ways. Don't try and sell it as something where the result matters. That's what sticks in the craw for me. And that's why I went to see a Holocaust movie while it was on. I actually did see quite a lot of it. It was on a bit later than I thought. Matt, sorry, I've eaten up all of the time and more, but I still want to hear your thoughts.
Well, it was a silly take that I loved the fact that the umpire was Greg Allensworth, who was the star of the show in the Rybakina Blinkova tiebreak. And I like to think that the Netflix producers watched that tiebreak and thought, he's our guy for Vegas.
There was a casting agent watching.
Loved it.
That is the ultimate Netflix slam take. Yeah, love that. Okay, that's it for the week that was. We have Indian Wells starting on Wednesday. The draw is done tonight. Who's going to win Indian Wells? Men's, women's, two words from each of you.
Świątek,
Rybakina, and Sinner.
Okay, great. We're supposed to be disagreeing more, guys. That's what our mate Dave wants from us. We'll work on that for next week.
It is quite an interesting angle now. Who can beat Jannik Sinner?
I love it when someone makes it to Indian Wells unbeaten. Yeah. That's fun. We have mascots. Yes, you heard me right. Mascots, plural, for this episode. And it is an interspecies couple. not a romantic couple. I don't think. An interspecies mascots. Inter-animal friendships are my favourite thing.
You're going to find out this is not a friendship.
Oh, I haven't read the blurb. I just saw the lovely pictures and thought, brilliant. Oh, because Instagram, the first thing I saw on Instagram this morning was a video of a puppy and a duckling being best friends. And I thought, oh, the internet knows me so well. Right. Okay. We have Mochi. It's either Mochi or Mochi. So I'll say both, assuming that one of them is right, with apologies for the one that's not right, and Grace. So Mochi is a rabbit and Grace is a dog, and they are owned by Elizabeth, who says, Mochi is a 10-year-old rescue rabbit. We have had her since she was 3 months old. Her mum was found on the side of the road by rescuers and was pregnant. We adopted Mochi from an animal rescue in Northern Virginia. Last year, Grace was a pet mascot for the podcast, and this year we wanted Mochi to be involved too. Mochi and Grace live separately in the house, like roommates who don't get along. Oh, we've all been there. Roommates who don't get along. My husband has to hold Mochi, when they are in the same room because, weirdly enough, Grace is terrified of Mochi. We love them both, though. Thank you for creating and producing a great podcast. Thank you, Elizabeth, for these lovely animals. If you don't mind, I don't want to live in a false news reality, but in my mind, I am going to pretend that they're best friends.
Grace does look terrified, I gotta say.
Grace does look a bit terrified. I do. I like rabbits. I like a rabbit. They're cute. They're very soft and fluffy. I think we could be in a roommates who don't get along situation if I got a rabbit in from a Billie Jean perspective. But anyway, you roll in fox poo, Billie Jean, and you get no say in what goes down around these parts. Billie Jean, in all her smelly glory, is sponsored by Billie Jean King and Alana Kloss. We have our mascot. I've got the dearly departed Darwin, who I'm still yet to score points in the memory of, but I shall keep trying. David has Francis, and Matt has Haida and Soma. We have top folks and executive producers Jamie, Jeff, Chris and Greg, and Matt, we have shout outs.
We have Tristan Amy, who is in Pennsylvania.
Tristan.
Hello, Tristan.
We know Tristan. He's been a listener since 2021, and he says he's been making his way through the archives.
Oh no, wow. Tristan.
Go on, Tristan. Good work.
Do you know what? There are foregone conclusion. Tennis Tristans.
No.
I can't think of any.
It's not a very sporting name, is it?
Oh,
I can't think of any sporting Tristans. No, I didn't say unathletic, Matt. I said not very sporting. It's more kind of, you know, Tristan and Isolde. It's more that vibe. Knights of the Round Table energy. Thank you, Tristan.
Cheers, Tristan.
We've also got Jonathan Enever, who is in Melbourne.
Jonathan.
Hello, Jonathan.
He moved to Melbourne from the UK 12 years ago, and when he arrived, he found out that you could just buy tickets for the finals of the Australian Open, unlike Wimbledon. So he's been to lots of great Australian Open finals.
Imagine that, just being able to buy tickets for tennis.
What a concept.
What a concept. Love that, like for that, you, Jonathan.
Like that 90s player, Jonathan Stark, who used to be part of a very good doubles partnership. Who remembers him?
I'll take your word for that, David.
Bit of a blonde bombshell he was, as I recall.
Googling him.
Jonathan, that's probably not what you were expecting. I hope you enjoyed it. Thank you for being a friend of the pods.
And finally, we have Nadia Hamya in Paris.
Hello, Nadia.
Nadia says, I cannot decide whether my favourite pod is the Northern Lights pod or the Diego Maradona pod. You had me in tears on the commute on the Paris metro.
Oh, well, I feel very proud.
That is a tough choice. I agree. David has now gifted me an incredibly excellent and niche gift. It's a no-laying-up T-shirt, but that has Northern Lights-based branding on it. It's excellent.
Yeah. I had to explain it. but you,
like
you
all
seemed
great
quite
gifts.
Pleased once I had.
Any tennis Nadias?
Podoroska.
Sure. Podoroska.
Oh, she reached the semi-finals in COVID year.
French Open semi-finalist Nadia Podoroska. There you go,
in
Nadia.
October. Goodness.
Oh, happy memories. That's two pandemic mentions we've had in a Podoroska and a Garin context. Right, enough of that. Thank you ever so much for listening. If you want to become a friend, you know what to do. We have our newsletter coming. And the link to subscribe to that is in our show notes, as always. And we'll be back with our weekly podcast midway through Indian Wells on Monday. We'll speak to you then.